Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. My name is Nancy, and you are listening to the Environment Program. This week, we'll be hearing a Leave No Trace confessional from someone feeling guilty about something they did to the environment. Then we'll hear about four edible plants for beginning foragers who are out hiking. We'll hear about legislators who toured recycling facilities in Boulder, Larimer, and Broomfield counties and why they did that. And we'll hear about a climate scientist who traveled from Amsterdam to Boulder without taking a flight in an effort to increase his sustainability and how he did that. But first, we'll start with an opinion piece from Backpacker magazine. Hunters pay for conservation. Hikers should too. Hunters fund conservation through taxes and tag fees. As their numbers decline, it's time for hikers to step up. And this opinion piece is from Heather Balog Rockfort, written September 5th. 25 years ago, my Uncle Herb's hunting cabin was a hive of activity. Come autumn, a boisterous pack of my relatives would arrive at the shack in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. They'd drop their duffels and coolers, put on their highlighter orange apparel, and shoulder their rifles in search of the guest of honor, a whitetail buck. Today, the hunting cabin is silent. Windows boarded shut and overgrown shrubs lining the perimeter. Uncle Herb passed away 10 years ago, and with him went the last vestiges of an old family tradition. Neither my cousins, my sister, nor I hunt, either out of moral qualms or disinterest. Either way, few of the folks in my generation seem keen on taking up arms, and we're not alone. According to a 2016 survey by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, less than 5% of Americans older than 16 hunt. That's half the percentage that hit the woods 50 years ago. Despite recent government efforts to preserve this heritage activity, the downward trend is only expected to continue as millennials opt out and the old guard ages out. Some wildlife advocates applaud the shift, but the issue is more complicated than it appears, and the dwindling number of hunters is not without consequences. Lifelong hunter Teddy Roosevelt was alarmed by the loss of species and habitat, and when he became president, he created the United States Forest Service to protect 230 million acres of public land. Then he required hunters to pay for the privilege of hunting the wildlife that lived there. Today, nearly 60% of funding for state wildlife agencies' conservation funds comes from the hook-and-bullet crowd through tag fees, fishing permits, and the Pittman-Robertson Act, which levies an 11% tax on ammo and arms. But there's a catch. The only way states can access that cash is if they put up 25% matching funds from their own coffers. With fewer license sales, states aren't able to raise the same dollar totals that they used to. All of which presents a challenge. Hunters may be fading, but the number of hikers, skiers, and paddlers are increasing, and conservation needs funding more than ever. One solution, a small conservation tax on outdoor gear. Charging a penny on the dollar for a sleeping bag or pair of skis won't make up all of the lost revenues from firearm sales, but it shows that we, as users of public lands, are ready to be part of the funding picture. We need to get some skin in the game. I can hear the protests from friends who already complain when they have to pay a modest trailhead parking fee. But hunters pay that and the firearm tax. They accept the cost as part of doing and preserving the activity they love. That's a spirit I can get behind. And if we don't figure out a way to put our money where our boots are, we might look back in a few decades and realize we have nowhere left to put them at all. The next piece is also from Backpacker Magazine. Leave No Trace Confessional. I dropped a case of beer cans into a creek. An accidental litterer receives their penance in this edition of Leave No Trace Confessional. This is dated September 17th. Some friends and I polished off a 12-pack of beer while camping near a creek in the national park. We left the empties on the bank and went to bed. Torrential rain fell during the night, causing the creek to rise. I woke up to find all of the cans had been swept away. We hiked downstream to look for them, but no luck. I feel terrible about it. Signed, Backcountry Bender. Dear Bender, well, unless some park employee or volunteer picked up those empties, they're definitely still out there. Aluminum cans take hundreds of years to decompose. We hear the remorse in your letter, but still have to point out that you should secure all of your trash before going to sleep, no matter how trashed you might be. In addition to littering, you could have attracted some local wildlife to your campsite. Bears and other animals like beer, maybe as much as you do, and can sniff out your empties. Also, reading between the lines, it doesn't seem like your campsite was 200 feet from the creek. Unless it's a designated site, you'll need to choose a better spot next time. Booze and the backcountry can mix, but do so responsibly. Happy hour shouldn't become a sad day for wildlife and other hikers. Your penance. Remember those park volunteers who hopefully cleaned up your mess? Welcome to their ranks. Join a river cleanup. If you pick up 6 cans for every one you left, you'll feel better. The next article is also from Backpacker. 4 edible plants for beginner foragers. Chow down on these edible plants, all found across the U.S. Brianna Wiles, author of Mountain States Foraging and owner of Rooted Apothecary, and Kat McGinnon, botany program director at the Colorado School of Clinical Herbalism, give you the goods. This article is dated September 9. Okay, the first edible, pine, where various species of this conifer can be found growing in well-drained soil throughout North America. Harvest year-round. The needle, bark, seeds, and cones of all pine species are edible. A tangy tea can be made by infusing the needles in hot water. They're too fibrous to eat more than a few raw. The male cones, smaller than females and best when immature, seeds produced by mature female cones and white inner bark can all be eaten as a trailside nibble. American plum. This scraggly tree can be found at lower elevations below 7,000 feet, across the continent, in canyons, hillsides, and along roadsides. Look for them near water sources, such as rivers and creeks. The harvest, fruits in late August. The tart and sweet plum can be eaten straight off the branch as a snack, cooked in campfire dessert crumbles, or made into fruit leathers, sweet and sour sauces, or jellies. The next edible is wild grape. Look near the banks of streams and in moist soils to find this. The fruits usually ripen in late summer to early fall, but the sweet, tart bounty can sometimes be found hanging down from 10 to 60 foot vines into the winter months if birds don't get them first. Bake into a backcountry pie or simply enjoy a mid-hike treat. In the spring, add the new growth of the slightly coiled tendrils to salads for a satisfyingly fresh and sour crunch. And last, cattails. Look for them in wetlands, swamps, and riverbanks. Eat different parts year-round. The underground stems or rhizomes, shoots, immature flower spikes, and pollen of the cattail are edible. The starchy sweet rhizomes can be gathered in the fall through early spring. The green bean-like shoots are best in spring, and the flower spikes and pollen can be harvested in early summer. Above-ground parts can be used in soups, stir-fries, or steamed. The next article comes from the Boulder Daily Camera. Legislators tour Boulder County recycling facilities in search of solutions for state's recycling woes, by John Spina, dated September 11th. Despite its green reputation, Colorado produced a record 9,307,000 tons of waste in 2018, only 12% of which was recycled, far below the national average of 35%, according to EcoCycle. While Boulder County outpaced its counterparts with 40% of its waste recycled, as did Boulder, which recycled or composted 57% of its waste, other progressive cities around the country, such as San Francisco and Portland, recycled 80% and 70% of their waste, respectively. On Monday, several members of the Colorado Legislature's Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Committee toured recycling facilities in Boulder, Larimer, and Broomfield counties to better understand how they could craft legislation to boost Colorado's recycling system. The main difference between Colorado and California, according to Kate Bailey, the Solutions Director for Ecosystems, is the cost of landfills is nearly twice as high in more densely populated areas of California, which also make those areas more attractive to the companies that repurpose recycled material. We need to be selling materials out our back door to cover our costs, Bailey said. With recycling being more expensive than landfills, what makes this facility work right now is that cities have recycling programs that bring us their materials for free, but we need to be focused on creating end markets for our materials so we offset future costs. End market businesses would not only make recycling centers more profitable, but also would reduce the costs and environmental impact of shipping sorted material to end market businesses out of state, she said. The first step, Bailey said, is to make municipal recycling programs more prevalent. Currently, only 15 cities in Colorado automatically provide households with a recycling cart, while 25 counties provide no curbside recycling at all. In many of those areas, drop-off centers are also few and far between. With more recycling municipal programs, the price of recycling will fall as convenience increases, allowing the state to produce more material for end market businesses to repurpose, incentivizing them to open factories in Colorado, and allowing them to not only divert more waste from the landfills, but also reduce greenhouse gas emissions, said Bailey and Dan Match, the manager of EcoCycle's Center for Hard-to-Recycle Materials. However, because many smaller communities cannot afford the equipment used to sort and bundle recycling, the ideal situation, Mach said, is to have a regional hub where all of the communities along the Front Range can combine resources. Committee member Senator Kevin Priola, Republican from Henderson, spoke with fellow committee member Representative Mark Catlin, Republican from Montrose, about the possibility of setting up a system where Montrose could truck its recyclable plastics, paper, and glass to the Front Range, where they could be processed and sold to manufacturers. On the way back, the truck could carry organic materials from the Front Range that could be used for compost on Montrose's many farms. For the time being, however, the Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Committee is focused on the lower-hanging fruit. It's clear we need to incentivize recycling infrastructure to get companies here, said Lisa Cutter, Democrat from Evergreen, chair of the committee. If we don't, then it doesn't matter. While the Zero Waste and Recycling Interim Committee will not begin the process of submitting ideas for legislation until Tuesday, the group has been gathering information on Colorado's recycling infrastructure since July and already had some ideas in play on Monday. The first is to design and fund a state-level recycling market development center. The center would assist existing and new end-market recycling business to evaluate opportunities, advocate for local and statewide recycling policies to increase the supply of recycled materials, and educate the public about the importance of recycling. The second is to provide both business and personal property tax relief for new and existing businesses that participate in the recycling economy. And now we'll move to the Boulder Weekly for an article about a climate scientist who traveled from Amsterdam to Boulder without taking a flight to minimize his carbon footprint. The title, 5 Years in 2 Months' Time, by Lauren Hamkin, dated September 12th. The most challenging part about spending 9 weeks traveling 6,400 miles on a catamaran may not be the seasickness, but the boredom of being on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with only 3 other people to talk to. However, for Joep van Dijk, a 28-year-old geologist specializing in historic climate research, the seasickness and boredom was worth it if it meant minimizing his personal impact on the ongoing climate crisis. Actually, for Van Dijk, it was far from boring. It was exhilarating. You have no society around you. It's just you, the water, and simple life, he says. Van Dijk began his journey from Amsterdam to Colorado after accepting a position as a researcher at the Institute for Alpine and Arctic Research at the University of Colorado Boulder. While the most convenient way to travel to Colorado from Europe is by plane, one round-trip flight from Amsterdam to Denver emits approximately 2 tons of carbon dioxide directly into the atmosphere. The aviation industry alone contributes about 2% to the total amount of greenhouse gas emission in the atmosphere. So, Van Dijk made the journey by train, boat, bike, bus, and even a little bit of hitchhiking. Van Dijk's interest in the climate began when he was 18, after he built a solar panel for his school. As he continued to observe the negative effects of the climate crisis, Van Dijk became increasingly cautious of his personal contributions to it. At one point, I was like, screw this, I'm done, Van Dijk says. You have to make egoistic choices in life, and your own happiness is very important. But is your own happiness more important than the happiness of future generations? In January 2019, Van Dischke left his home in Amsterdam, traveling by train to the Canary Islands, where he crossed the Atlantic on a boat. 3 weeks after leaving the Canary Islands, Van Dischke reached Barbados. On his way to a U.S. port, Van Dischke sailed to Georgetown, Nassau, and Freeport, learning about the culture of each island along the way. On one of his stops, Van Dischke even saved a man's life. I saw this face in the distance, and it went underwater. I was thinking, no way, is this really happening right now? Van Dischke says. After 1 minute of contemplation, I decided to jump in, and I swam over. It was this old, drunk Frenchman. He almost died. 6 weeks later, Van Dischke arrived in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He took an overnight Greyhound bus to New Orleans. From Louisiana, Van Dischke rode his bike through Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado, a 1,600-mile course. The ride took 3 weeks, and Van Dischke arrived at his destination, CU Boulder, on Sunday, March 31st. My boss was waiting for me at the Institute, he says. That was a good moment. We went to his place. I spent a couple of days there, drank some beers, cooked some nice dinners. That's when the whole Boulder adventure started. Although the trip was long and grueling, he feels as if he personally grew and matured by 5 years in 2 months' time. He learned how to listen to himself, to what he wants, and to not succumb to what others expect from him. Van Dischke says he also learned how to listen to others and understand people on his journey. When you are with 4 people on a ship, you realize the importance of companionship and social interaction. In this world where everything is so individual, we often forget how important it is to have human interaction. Apart from choosing not to fly, Van Dischke makes decisions in his everyday life to ensure he is living sustainably. He is a vegetarian and lives in a co-op house. He and his roommates routinely buy products in bulk to minimize packaging and waste less food. He minimizes his plastic usage when possible and makes local and seasonal choices when shopping. Every day you have to go against the system. It takes energy, says Van Dischke. Van Dischke filmed and photographed his adventure to Boulder and is making a documentary of his journey, which he hopes will encourage people to focus on minimizing their own personal carbon footprint. The film, Carbon Dioxide, That's Not Right, is slated for release in the spring of 2020. Slow travel is not really slow, Van Dischke says. Someone told me the other day, if you grew 5 years in 2 months' time, is that slow travel? No, it's not. It's fast travel. And we have time for one more Leave No Trace confessional. I killed a skunk. We're not going to lie to you. This is bad. I was camping in Pennsylvania when a skunk nosed under my tarp. I bolted and it moved on, but it kept coming back. The fourth time, I threw some stones to scare it off and landed a direct hit, severely maiming it. I knew it wouldn't survive, so I did the only thing I could think of in the face of its suffering and performed the coup de grace with a rock. I still feel terrible. What should I have done differently? Signed, Bill Killed in Boulder. Dear Bill, sorry, no sugarcoating for you. This is terrible. That skunk was associating you with food or salt. Entering your shelter was like visiting a restaurant. This is common behavior for smaller mammals like skunks, raccoons, and marmots, and they can be persistent, as you well know. You weren't wrong to try to scare her off, but that's small consolation to the dead skunk. Keeping a clean camp is the first step to avoiding unwanted visitors. But if a critter still sniffs you out, try a non-lethal method, such as banging on your cook pot. If all else fails, a marine-grade air horn should do the trick. It may seem silly to carry something like that in the backcountry, but it's lighter than a regret. Do the right thing. It seems like there was an element of bad luck at play, so we'll go easy on you. Carry the air horn as penance and clean up micro trash at every campsite you sleep in to help break the association between hikers and food. If the salty sweat in your shoulder straps, hiking pole, handle, or boots will be irresistible, hang your gear in a tree. We've reached the end of our program for this week. Please join us again next week for the Environment Program. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.